So the description of the first jhana starts out with secluded from sense desires, secluded from unwholesome states, one enters and remains in the first jhana. This seclusion from sense desires, secluded from unwholesome states, refers to the abandoning of the hindrances, the five mind states that hinder progress on the spiritual path. And so tonight, that's what I'm going to talk about. The hindrances are described very frequently in the suttas, or the abandoning of the hindrances, because they're not just described, it's always in terms of abandoning them. They show up in the gradual training, the path of practice that the Buddha laid out for the monastics at that time. And they show up, the abandoning of the hindrances shows up just before the description of the jhanas. What I want to do tonight is take a look at what's found in Digha Nikaya number 2, the Discourse on the Fruits of the Spiritual Life, in regard to the hindrances. Having abandoned covetousness for the world, one dwells with a mind free from covetousness. One purifies one's mind from covetousness. So the first hindrance here is given as covetousness for the world. Often in other suttas we find it described as the desire for sense pleasures or the desire for sensual gratification. They're both pointing to the wanting state of mind. When you find yourself distracted and wanting there to be chocolate for dessert, or wanting a more comfortable pillow, or wanting, okay, the active wanting, that would fall under this category. The Buddha was great for giving similes, and he provided similes in many, many different situations, including for the hindrances. In this sutta, he says, suppose a man were to take a loan and apply it to his business, and his business were to succeed so that he could pay back his old debts and would have enough money left over to maintain a family. He would reflect on this, and as a result, he would become glad and experience joy. So, sense desire is like being in debt. If you're in debt, you must continually work to pay off the debt. You can't call up the bank and say, well, look, I want to go on retreat this month. It's a really noble thing to do, so I want to just skip paying the house payment. You can't even call them up and say, I lost my job. They'll still come and take your house away. It's the same with the sense pleasures. No sense pleasure is ultimately satisfying. If you see a truly magnificent sunset, when it's all done, you don't go, oh, that was such a beautiful sunset, I never have to see another sunset again. Or you eat a really delicious bowl of ice cream and think, wow, so good, I never have to eat ice cream again. I mean, this just doesn't occur. It's like, I'm going out tomorrow night and see if I can see another sunset. Or I'm going to have ice cream tomorrow. Right? So any sense pleasure is not ultimately satisfying and only leads to the pursuit of getting the sense pleasure again. And so in that sense, it's like being in debt. The Buddha also compared the desire for sense pleasures to a small bowl of water that many colored dyes have been poured into it. And if you try and look into the depths, you can't see anything because the colors, well, distract you from seeing into the depths. This is very much like what the desire for sense pleasures does to us. We just simply get distracted by the wanting and can't really see what's going on. In the new sub-commentary, okay, so there are the suttas, and then for each sutta, there's a commentary that was written much later, about 900 years after the Buddha's death, in Sri Lanka, that explains what the sutta means. or at least what the sutta meant to the guy who wrote the commentary. And then there's a sub-commentary, which explains what the commentary meant. Because sometimes the commentary is like, what? And this explains that. But there's a new sub-commentary, a commentary to the sub-commentary, that explains what the sub-commentary meant, and maybe even explains what the commentary meant a little bit better. And sometimes there's actually something useful in all that massive commentarial material. Sometimes. From the new sub-commentary, what has been done is collect things that are given in the suttas for helping with abandoning the hindrances. And so this material actually does come from the suttas, but has been collected here into a list of 6 things to be developed for the abandoning of sensual desire. They are learning the sign of the unattractive, that is, the repulsive nature of the body, application to meditation on the unattractive, guarding the doors of the sense faculties, moderation in eating, noble friends and noble conversations. It may not be the list you were hoping for. Okay, learning the sign of the unattractive, that is, the repulsive nature of the body, and application to meditation on the unattractive. At the time of the Buddha, and for quite some time thereafter, if you had a lot of sense desire, particularly a lot of lust, then the meditation practice they would give you was to go sit in a charnel ground in front of a decaying body and meditate on that corpse to recognize that the one you were lusting after is going to wind up like that, and you're going to wind up like that. I suppose it was an effective method because it did stick around for quite a while. We don't have charnel grounds here. We have cemeteries. Cemeteries are actually very nice. You know, little statues, and they cut the grass. It's a good place. One of my friends, when I was traveling, told me, if ever you can't find a place to stay, go sleep in the cemetery. Nobody will bother you. He was right. It's a great emergency place to sleep. But a charnel ground is where they dumped the bodies of those who didn't have enough money for a cremation. A human body is not an easy thing to burn. It takes a lot of firewood. Somebody has to pay for the firewood. And if you just don't have that kind of money, well, they'd haul you off to the charnel ground and dump your body where it would rot. And so, yeah, you'd go to meditate in the charnel ground if you had a lot of sense desire. This doesn't really fit 21st century Western civilization. Some of what we find in Buddhism is very much tailored to a culture from long ago that was really very different. Learning the sign of the unattractive and application to meditation on the unattractive doesn't really fit a culture where the idea of, yeah, you have to remain 25 years old forever, or at least look like you're 25 years old, is the dominant paradigm. I would say that in this culture, what we need to do is get a realistic view of the body. It's a vehicle. It's a quite useful vehicle. It can be a source of pleasure, and it can be a source of dukkha. It does need maintaining, not just regular fuel, but it needs things like exercise and so forth. And so I would say for Westerners, these first two are more about getting a healthy view of the body. And a healthy view in the sense of realizing that it is going to wear out and that it does require this maintenance. That you take care of it, you give it the exercise and the good food, so that it doesn't wear out as fast. But no matter how much exercise and how much good food, it is eventually going to wear out. So that's the first two. The third one is guarding the doors of the sense faculties. What this means is not that you don't see, you don't hear, etc. Our senses are tools that we use to navigate the environment. And we actually do need the sensory input. But we don't need to get lost in the sensory input. Guarding the doors of the sense faculty means that you see what's there, and that's it. You don't get lost in wanting it or into this wonderful phrase in Pali, papancha, mental proliferation. I mean, you're walking down the main street and you look in a shop window and you see something that's very appealing. And it's like, wow, I should get one of these. I mean, I've got money on my credit card. I never even knew this existed. Okay, you weren't guarding the doors of your sense faculties, and you've become trapped in this wanting, right? And so if you were guarding the doors of the sense faculties, you would see whatever this is and go, oh, that's interesting, and keep on walking. You pass the bakery. The bakery always has its door open. How about that? The smell comes out. They want to lure you in. If you're guarding the doors of the sense faculties, you take a very deep inhale through your nose and enjoy the pleasant smell and keep walking. If you're not guarding the doors of the sense faculties, you make an abrupt right turn and start stuffing your face with this big jelly donut or whatever. Okay? So guarding the doors of the sense faculties means that you're acting wisely on the input as opposed to getting lost on the input that comes through your senses. Moderation in eating. On a retreat like this, not a lot of excitement about the only source of sense pleasures is the food. And there's a temptation, because it is the only source of sense pleasures, to overdo it. To, yeah, have one more great big peanut butter and jelly sandwich, or another serving of ice cream if there's ice cream available, or whatever. As I mentioned, this can be problematic from a needing to digest standpoint and makes you sleepy. But it also, if you're overindulging in it, can trigger obsessive thoughts about food. So you sit down to meditate and you're wondering what we're going to have for lunch. And are we going to have dessert again? And who's all the nice people that are making the donations so that we have all these desserts? And I hope they keep it up. And I hope they have brownies. And that's not going to get you anywhere near the jhanas, let alone transformative insight. So if you eat a moderate amount of food, then you're less likely to get caught up in desiring the one entertainment that there seems to be on a retreat. And then noble friends and noble conversations. I'm going to defer talking about that for the moment. I wish I had a better list to give you. When Ayakema, on that first retreat I did, gave her talk on the hindrances, she prefaced it by saying, pay attention. You may find that one of these hindrances is your major hindrance. And right off I could tell, yep, the sense desire one is probably going to be mine. And yep, that's still the case. So when I say I wish I had a better list to give you, it's because if I had a better list to give you, I'd have that list. The best thing I can say is when you find something desirable, try and get a realistic view of it. Nothing really is perfect. Okay? That person, if they're perfect, they're probably not interested in you. Right? And if they're not perfect, well, all your fantasies aren't going to overcome their imperfections. That shiny new toy, whatever it is, it's going to be less than perfect. It's going to wear out. It's going to need to be insured. It's going to fall out of your pocket or whatever. Okay? So get a realistic picture. If you find yourself drawn to something, instead of getting lost in the fantasy of how fabulous it's going to be once you get it, see if you can also notice the drawbacks of it. I remember when I was a kid, in November, the Sears and Roebuck catalog would come. And you turn to the back and there was the toy section. And it was fantastic. And I would find that toy I was going to have Santa Claus bring me. And I would spend an entire month anticipating how fantastic it was going to be. And I got it because Santa was good to me. And, well, it just never, ever, ever measured up to all the fantasies. Right? So whatever sense desire you have, it's just going to be another Sears and Roebuck catalog. It's not going to measure up to that in real life. And if you can get a realistic picture of whatever it is you're desiring, yeah, then it may help you to let go of the desire. The second of the hindrances. Having abandoned ill will and hatred, one dwells with a benevolent mind, sympathetic for the welfare of all living beings. So the second hindrance is ill will and hatred. That's really the most egregious form of this hindrance. We could say that the first two hindrances are wanting and aversion, or wanting and not wanting. And the most extreme form of not wanting would be ill will and hatred. Notice also that it says one dwells with a benevolent mind, sympathetic for the welfare of all living beings. Remember when I talked about the precepts? I said that the precepts have multiple levels. And the first one about not killing, that was the basic level. But at the highest level, you wanted to love all beings, and that's what that's saying. To act for the welfare of all beings, to have a benevolent mind. Buddha gives a simile. Suppose a man were to become sick, afflicted, gravely ill, so that he could not enjoy his food and his strength would decline. After some time, he would recover from that illness and would enjoy his food and regain his bodily strength. He would reflect on this, and as a result, he would become glad and experience joy. So ill will and hatred is like being physically ill. If you're physically ill, you don't feel well. You can't think straight. You're hot. You can't do what you want to do. If you're overcome with ill will and hatred, you don't feel well. You can't think straight. You're hot. You can't do what you want to do. It really is a very good analogy here. The Buddha also compared ill will and hatred to a bowl of water that's sitting over a fire, and it's boiling. And if you try and look into the depths, because of all the bubbles and steam, you can't see into the depths. He also compared ill will and hatred to picking up hot coals and throwing them at someone. Now, if the other person has any sense at all, they don't try and catch the coals so they can throw them back. Who's guaranteed to get burned? The one throwing the coals. Often what happens, though, is somebody gets angry with us, expressing their ill will and hatred, and we just get angry right back at them. Now, this might have made some sense back on the savannah in Africa, there's a threat and you make yourself bigger than the threat. But that was a long time ago. If somebody gets angry at you, there's no reason that you necessarily have to get angry back at them. If you can keep your cool, you can probably diffuse the situation in a much better way than if you escalate the situation. Of course, they might get upset the fact that you're not getting upset, but that's their problem still. There's an interesting sutta where a Brahmin comes to see the Buddha, and he's very upset because, you see, his younger brother had come to see the Buddha a few days before, and the Buddha corrupted his younger brother. His younger brother became a monk. And so this Brahmin is coming and giving the Buddha what for and calling him a corrupter of the youth and just going on and on and on. Finally, he pauses for a breath, and the Buddha says, "Excuse me, do you ever give a feast?" Brahmin, "Yes, of course I give a feast." "Do you prepare nice food for the feast?" "Of course I prepare nice food." "Well then, Brahmin, suppose you were to give a feast and prepare nice food, But nobody came. To whom would the food belong? Belong to me. Just so, Brahman, I'm not coming to your feast. The Brahman was so impressed that he too became a monk. Right? So, yeah, you don't have to respond with escalating a situation where there's ill will and hatred coming at you. Luckily, in the new sub-commentary, there are six things to be developed for the abandoning of ill will and hatred. They are learning the sign of loving kindness, metta, application to meditation on loving kindness, reflection on the ownership of action, abundance of wise reflection, noble friends, and noble conversations. So if you're having an attack of ill will and hatred, or just aversion to anything that's out of hand, the thing to do is stop whatever practice you are attempting to do and switch to doing metta meditation. You don't have to do metta for the person with whom you're feeling the ill will, the hatred, the anger. Just do metta for somebody. Do it for yourself. Do it for your friend. Do it for the Dalai Lama. All right? Just find somebody that you can do the metta for. This basically fills up your mind with the opposite of the anger, ill will, hatred that's coming. And you do the metta long enough until you feel like you've calmed down. And then, yeah, if you want to, you can keep doing the metta practice, or you can switch back to whatever your original meditation object was. Metta is a really powerful practice. If they were to come to me and say, you can only do one practice, choose, I would unhesitatingly choose metta. I'll tell you a story. Back in 1990, I got divorced. 1974, 1975, I got divorced. Right, a long time ago. It was not a pleasant experience. Let's just say it left me with the attitude of, I hate your guts. Right? So now, 10 years later, I go on my first retreat with Ayakema. And she does the guided meditation, much like I'm doing it in the evenings, with the various categories. And then she gets to the difficult person. Actually, what she said was, think of your enemy. Well, I knew who my enemy was. Anybody that would... So I had to give her some metta, and I really didn't want to, but it was like, okay, you're going to have a little metta. And then I had to do it the next day, too, and the next day, and every day. Well, I liked doing the metta practice, all but that part of it, but there was my teacher, who actually seemed to know what she was talking about, saying I was supposed to do this every day, saying I was supposed to do metta at the start of all of my meditation periods. And I liked her 10, 15-minute guided metta. So, yeah, at the start of all of my meditation periods, I start out by doing 10, 15 minutes of metta, including giving my ex-wife a little bit of metta. And over the next 5 years, my attitude went from I hate your guts to, gee, I wish you hadn't done that. And then suddenly one day I got a letter from my ex-wife. And in the letter, she said, I was wrong, please forgive me. And I was astonished. I have no idea why she wrote the letter. But I do know that the next day when I did my metta practice, I had to put her in the category of neutral person. All of my negativity towards her was gone. 5 years of doing metta for her, and then this letter just completely took care of the problem. Of course, it wasn't any trouble to find any other difficult people. There are always plenty of politicians around. So definitely recommend metta practice. And if you find yourself meditating and in an angry or upset negative state, do some metta for somebody. The third one is reflection on the ownership of actions. Actions have consequences, and we will have to suffer the consequences. Did you ever do something when you were angry that wasn't the wisest thing? Right? But you can't call up the karma gods and go, sorry, I was angry then. Can we just, like, let this go? Doesn't work that way. So, actually, if you're in a really aversive state of mind, you're in a powerless state of mind, in the sense that any action that you do is not likely to be the wisest course of action, and yet you will still have to suffer the consequences of whatever action you do under the influence of that anger. Abundance of wise reflection. When you're in an aversive state of mind, pay attention to what it's like to be in an aversive state of mind. Is it pleasant? Well, probably not. It's actually kind of a miserable place to be. It's not a place you really want to hang out. It's probably not doing any good. If you're sitting here and you're angry at somebody who's multiple miles away, like at your job or something, your anger is not going to fix whatever the problem is. It's just going to mess up your retreat. So getting in touch with the uselessness of this mind state may be of some help in letting it go, especially if you can couple that with switching to doing some metta practice. And then noble friends and noble conversations, which I will once again defer. The third hindrance. Having abandoned dullness and drowsiness, one dwells perceiving light, mindful and clearly comprehending. One purifies one's mind from dullness and drowsiness. So dullness and drowsiness, or perhaps sloth and torpor, is the more common translation. I've seen laziness and lassitude. Basically, a mind that doesn't have enough energy, or a body that doesn't have enough energy. The sloth would be the laziness, the mind that doesn't have enough energy to actually do the work. And the torpor would be the sleepiness, the falling asleep, the not enough physical energy. And again, the Buddha gives similes. Suppose a man were locked up in a prison. After some time, he would be released from prison safe and secure with no loss of his possessions. He would reflect on this, and as a result, he would become glad and experience joy. If you're in prison, you just sit there, missing out on all the good things of life. If you're overcome with sloth and torpor, you just sit there, missing out on the opportunity for spiritual practice, all the good things of the spiritual life. But if someone were to gain their freedom from prison, that'd be a good thing. If you can overcome sloth and torpor, that's definitely a good thing. The Buddha compared sloth and torpor to a bowl of water that has algae and weeds growing in it. Again, you can't see into the depths. Luckily, there are six things to be developed for abandoning sloth and torpor. Number one, recognizing that overeating is a basis for sloth and torpor. Changing the postures, attention to the perception of light, living in the open air, noble friends and noble conversations. So again, if you're feeling sleepy, eat less food. If you eat a lot of food, then it's going to slow down your digestive process and it's going to make you sleepy. So eating less food actually helps to overcome two of the five hindrances. It helps to overcome sensual desire, and it helps to overcome at least the sleepiness part of sloth and torpor. Overeating can even make you mentally sluggish. Although it's your body that's actually sluggish, you just really don't feel like doing anything. Changing the postures, attention to the perception of light, living in the open air. All of these really are about the physical sleepiness. So the things to do to overcome sleepiness are open your eyes, stare at the brightest light you can find, pinch and pull on your earlobes, pinch the acupressure points on the side of your ears. If you squeeze those really good, wiggle them around a bit, that'll bring some energy, keep you awake at least for a few minutes. And if all else fails, stand up. If you're standing up with your eyes open, you're not likely to fall asleep. Now, if you're standing and doing standing meditation, it's very important that you flex your knees. Right? If you lock your knees, you'll pass out. This will entail dukkha arising in your person and the person upon whom you collapse. Right? So flex your knees a little bit. When doing standing meditation, you can continue to follow the breathing or do the metta meditation or whatever you were doing, but also you can put your attention in your feet and notice the subtle movements that you're making to keep your balance. And that can be quite engaging. And you can use that as the meditation method as well. So most of what these six things are for the sleepiness. I'm again going to defer noble friends and noble conversations. For the laziness of mind, one thing that Ayakema suggested was give yourself a pep talk. Okay, I'm on this retreat. You know, it's a really good opportunity. It's comfortable in the meditation hall. There's a lot of group energy going in the right direction. I don't have anything to worry about. They're going to feed me. All I got to do is show up and do this. I need to take advantage of this time or whatever can be inspiring. Sometimes I found it helpful to read something inspiring. If, say, I'm at home and I really don't want to meditate, then okay, well, I can at least read something. And so read a sutta or read something else that I find inspiring, and that can be very helpful for life. Okay, yeah, really, I do got to do this. So find ways to inspire yourself seems to be the best way for overcoming the laziness. Also remembering that, you know, you don't want to be laying on your deathbed going, gee, I wish I'd meditated some more. This is really kind of difficult to deal with. Right? So realizing that there is a great deal of benefit, and the time that you're going to have to reap that benefit is somewhat limited. The fourth of the hindrances, having abandoned restlessness and remorse, one dwells at ease within oneself with a peaceful mind. One purifies one's mind from restlessness and remorse. Usually you see it translated as restlessness and worry, but the Pali word actually means remorse. I would say worry, particularly worry about the future, would go under the second hindrance. It's aversion. Worrying about the future is actually a form of fear, and I would say that fear is actually at the basis of all aversion. I made the statement here one time that fear was at the basis of all hatred. And I got a note on the board that said, I hate broccoli, but I'm not afraid of it. And I said, actually, you are. You're afraid that if you put it in your mouth, you will experience unpleasant vedana. So it really is fear that's there. And so the basis, I would say, of the second hindrance is fear. And so worry about the future is based in fear. But this remorse that's spoken about here is more regretting the past. I shouldn't have said that. I shouldn't have done that. This sort of thing. And then the restlessness can be either physical or mental. Sometimes when you sit down, you just can't get comfortable, right? And no matter how you adjust, it's just not working. That's a sign of physical restlessness. Other times you sit down and your mind is just all over the place. It's just one distraction after the other. And it doesn't seem to have any pattern to it. And that's mental restlessness. The Buddha gives a simile. Suppose a man were a slave without independence, subservient to others, unable to go where he wants. After some time, he would be released from slavery and gain his independence. He would no longer be subservient to others, but a free man, able to go where he wants. He would reflect on this, and as a result, he would become glad and experience joy. So a slave is busy all the time, but busy doing what the master commands. Go there, do that, come here, do this. Not doing what the slave actually wants to do. And this is the same thing with restlessness. It's driving you all over the place. Driving you to, not be able to sit because your body won't get still or your mind won't get still. So it's a very excellent simile. Buddha also compared restlessness and remorse to a bowl of water with a strong wind blowing over the surface, making waves. Once again, you can't see into the depths. But luckily, there are six things to do for the abandoning of restlessness and remorse. They are much learning, interrogation, skill in the Vinaya, associating with senior monks, noble friends, and noble conversations. So, much learning. Learn what the path is about. Learn what the practices are. This can be helpful, particularly for overcoming the restless part, the mental restlessness. Interrogation. Ask questions. The Buddha was big into having people asking questions and providing the answers. So, ask questions. It's a very important thing to do. If ever you're on a retreat and they don't want you asking any questions, that's a sign that maybe you're not in the right place. No teacher really knows what the students actually need, and they can begin to understand what the students need if the students will ask questions. So definitely feel free to ask questions. Skill in the Vinaya. Skill in the precepts. The Vinaya is the rules for the monks and nuns, and this new sub-commentary was written particularly for monks. But for lay people, it's skill in the precepts. When you're skilled in the precepts, you're much likely to be restless. The kind of lifestyle you'll be leading when you are skilled in the precepts just leads to more peace of mind and therefore less restlessness. Also leads to not having done things about which you're remorseful. The skill in the precepts is really very, very helpful for avoiding situations where later there will be remorse. Associating with senior monks. Associating with those that really know the path of practice and learn from them what you can. And noble friends and noble conversations, which once again I will defer. The fifth of these hindrances is skeptical doubt. Having abandoned doubt, one dwells as one who has passed beyond doubt, unperplexed about wholesome states. One purifies one's mind from doubt. Doubt is, a very insidious hindrance, to quote Ayakama. Doubt can be about the Buddha. Did he really know what he was talking about? Was he really enlightened? Did he even exist? Doubt about the Dharma. Is it the truth? Did the Buddha's teaching really get preserved through this 2,500-year game of telephone? Doubt about the Sangha. Do these people know what they're doing? Does the teacher know what he's talking about? Is it possible for anybody else to make progress on the spiritual path? Doubt about the teacher. Doubt about oneself. That's probably the most awful form of doubt. I can't do this. This is too hard. The spiritual path is difficult. If it were easy, we'd all gotten enlightened a long time ago. All right? This is going to require some serious commitment, some serious work. The Dalai Lama says that you should measure your progress on the spiritual path in 5-year increments. Okay? It's not a quick fix. So, you've got to stick around and see what's going on. Now, this doesn't mean that any path you pick up, you've got to stick with it for 5 years. But it does mean you've got to stick with it long enough to see where it goes, and then really to get a sense of where it goes. If you find it going up dead ends, you obviously abandon it. But if it seems like it has a heart, it's going to take a while to see where it leads. We have simile, of course. Suppose a man with wealth and possessions were traveling along a desert road where food was scarce and dangers were many. After some time, you would cross over the desert and arrive safely in a village which is safe and free from danger. He would reflect on this, and as a result, he would become glad and experience joy. So someone on a perilous desert journey, where bandits abound and provisions are scarce, first thinks to go this way, but wait, no, there'll be bandits. Better to go this way, but no, there won't be any water. One does more starting and stopping than actually progressing. It's the same with doubt. You start doing vipassana, and it's kind of dry, and not a lot of excitement. Maybe you need something with a little more juice or something. I mean, look at the Tibetans. You know, they got these paintings, and they got these colors, and they got horns. Yeah, that's got to be where it's at. So you switch to doing Tibetan practice. But it turns out to be a little too Baroque, a little too Catholic. No, Zen, that's what it's got to be Zen. I mean, they got these cool stories, and I mean, look at their gardens. So you start doing Zen practice, and it turns out they hit you with a stick. No, Sufi dancing. You're not following anything far enough to see where it's leading, and all of this is about doubt. Okay, so you got to stick to the road. You got to give it a chance. As I said, 5 years to really see what's going on with any path or practice. And as I said, it doesn't mean that if you start on some path of practice and it seems wrong, that you've got to stick with it for 5 years before you change. But if you find one that you think might work, to really know if it's going to work, you're going to have to put in the time to see where it leads. The Buddha compared skeptical doubt to a bowl of water that's full of mud. Again, you can't look into the depths and see what's going on. But there are the six things to do for the abandoning of skeptical doubt. Much learning, interrogation, skill in the Vinaya, resolution, noble friends, and noble conversations. So this is quite similar for overcoming restlessness and remorse. Much learning. If you have doubts about what's going on, learn what's going on. See, does it make any sense? Interrogation. Ask questions. It's really an important part of the path. Skill in the precepts. One of the best ways to test this particular path is to make it a practice of keeping the precepts. If you keep the precepts, does this help your life go better? Okay, if that works, that's a hint that the path might work. All right, so it's an easy way to start testing out the path. Resolution. So resolve to follow the path far enough to see where it goes. Don't just switch to a different path the moment it's not giving you instant feedback. And noble friends and noble conversations. There's a sutta where Ananda, who was the Buddha's attendant, and another monk were having a discussion about what was the most important part of the spiritual path. Now, Ananda was a very gregarious and outgoing soul, and so he said that noble friends and noble conversations are half the holy life. And this other monk was the meditation master, and he said that meditation was half the holy life. And so, as always happens in this, they argued back and forth and then went to see the Buddha, saluted, sat down at one side. And Ananda said, "Venerable sir, I say that noble friends and noble conversations are half the holy life." And the Buddha says, "Do not say so, Ananda. Noble friends and noble conversations are the entire holy life." This is a really difficult path. And unless you're somebody of the stature of Siddhartha Gautama, it's going to be really, really difficult to do it by yourself. And so support from noble friends with whom you can have noble conversations is very, very important. And it serves as an antidote for all of these hindrances. When I was in teacher training with Jack Kornfield, one of the things that we did each time we got together was meet with some other teacher besides Jack. And one time we went to meet with Yvonne Rand. She was the person who blew the whistle on the sex scandal at the San Francisco Zen Center back several decades ago. And she said that it's extremely important, if I was going to be teaching, to have somebody who really knew who I was, that could really give me honest feedback, that wouldn't be projecting anything onto me. And she also said it was very important, I don't believe my publicity. And I thought those were two very, very helpful things. In fact, that was probably some of the most helpful advice I got from anyone during that training period. It really is important to have people that know who you are at your core, and when you start acting stupid, can tell you, hey, you're acting stupid. Right? This will help a lot at overcoming all of these hindrances. When one sees that these five hindrances are unabandoned within oneself, one regards that as a debt, as a sickness, as confinement in prison, as slavery, as a desert road. But when one sees that these five hindrances have been abandoned within oneself, one regards that as freedom from debt, as good health, as release from prison, as freedom from slavery, as a place of safety. Thus, secluded from sense desires, secluded from unwholesome states, one enters and remains in the first jhana. Questions? Comments?
Small, but how new are the new sub-commentaries, and where, honestly, I've never heard of them, where did you find them?
Okay, how new are the new sub-commentaries? All right, the commentaries were written by Buddhaghosa, who wrote the Visuddhimagga, or was the editor-in-chief of that project, and that was from the 5th century of the Common Era, so 5th century AD. The sub-commentary was probably from the next century, 6th century. The new sub-commentary, I think, was much later. Okay, it may be as late as the 15th, 16th century, but I'm not sure, I can't remember. Where did I find these? Bhikkhu Bodhi has, I think it's about 5 books. The one that I personally have is the Samanyapala Sutta and its commentaries. The Samanyapala Sutta is Digha Nikaya number 2. And so it has that sutta in his very excellent translation in the front, which takes up about a quarter of the book. And the last 3/4 are the commentary to that sutta, and the commentary to the commentary, and the commentary to the commentary to the commentary. And so the new sub-commentary and this list was in there. And so that's where I found it. There's these books for Digha Nikaya 1, 2, and 15, and for Majjhima Nikaya number 1. And they're published by the Buddhist Publication Society. And that's about the only place that I've ever found translations of the sutta commentaries. Most of that is still only available in Pali. So, but there's a little bit in there. And between what you find in Digha Nikaya 1's commentaries and Digha Nikaya 2's commentaries, you actually get a lot of commentary on a number of things like the precepts and guarding the senses and so forth. Other questions? Comments?
I think I saw that there was a mapping between the jhana factors and the specific
hindrances. Right. There's a classical modern teaching. I think it comes actually from the Visuddhimagga, so yeah, kind of modern, that maps the 5 hindrances to the 5 factors of the first jhana. There are, well, a couple of things that are kind of strange about that teaching. In the suttas, the first jhana only has four factors. So it's kind of hard to map five things, one-to-one to four things. Of course, they overcame by that by just adding another factor. All right, that factor got added in the Abhidhamma. All right, so 200 years after the Buddha's death, the understanding of the jhanas had changed enough so that the first jhana no longer had four factors, but had five. And then they start mapping this list of five hindrances to the five factors. I've written a book on the jhanas, which will be out next fall of 15. And I actually have an appendix in there taking a look at this mapping. And let's just say when I get done with it, I have completely shredded this. Okay. In the first place, the first two factors, vitaka and vichara, I'll talk about these in detail tomorrow night, are interpreted to mean initial and sustained attention to the meditation subject. But that's not what those words mean. So, all right, they blew it right there. All right. What they're saying is that the initial and sustained attention overcome the laziness with the initial, and the sustained overcomes the, which one is it? It's so weird. Well, I could see where sustained attention to your object of meditation would overcome your sensual desire, right? It would overcome your aversion, right? And it would overcome your restlessness, right? And you already overcame your sloth and torpor because you did the initial. And it would overcome your doubt because there would be no room for the doubt. That's why I can't remember which one it is, because it doesn't make much sense. And okay, so then we have the piti, which supposedly overcomes... Yeah, see, again, it just doesn't make much sense. Once you've got piti going, there's none of these hindrances going. Which once you have one pointedness, it's impossible to get any of these hindrances going. So a careful analysis of it, it's like somebody saw five of this and five of that and went, oh, it fits, look at that, by making stuff up. But if you start analyzing it, it just doesn't make any sense at all. In order to write that appendix, I actually had to look the stuff up because I just can't remember it because it's kind of weird. But yeah, it's a very common teaching, and actually Ayakema presents that teaching in her book When the Iron Eagle Flies. But once I started looking at it, it was like, nah, doesn't make any sense.
The one part of that does make sense to me, though, is particularly in the beginning of retreat, when I'm really tired and sleepy, there's no access, I can't look and look. So when I find the energy that comes with that, I mean, there's no sloth and torpor when I connect.
Mm-hmm. Right.
That's why I bought into those five.
Right.
But I've never really, yeah.
Yeah. But the interesting thing is that vitaka and vichara don't mean initial and sustained attention. They mean thinking and more thinking. Okay? So you've got to change what the words meant to the Buddha to initial and sustained before it even makes any sense. But the initial attention, and you're actually able to sustain it, yeah, that's really good. But you do that a lot, and it's not factors of the jhana. When you sit down and put your attention on the breath, that's initial attention. It has nothing to do with the jhana. When you sustain your attention on the breath, that's sustained attention. It has nothing to do with the jhana. When you put your attention on the pleasant sensation, that's initial attention. Still not any jhana yet, right? When you sustain your attention on the pleasant sensation, that's sustained attention, and you're still not to the jhana. And then, yeah, you do those when the piti and sukha arise. Yep, okay. But to move to the second jhana, you've also got to sustain your attention on it, and the third, and the fourth is different enough. It's going to require another initial and sustained attention. So it makes no sense to point these out and say they're factors of the first jhana. Yes, you do have to do initial and sustained attention. And you actually have to do it quite a lot. It's just, that's not what those words mean. So, that's my beef with it. And a little over a year from now, you can buy the book and get the whole lot.
Would you talk some more about mental restlessness and what that looks like, what it tastes like?
Mental restlessness often for me is I find I'm sitting down to meditate and it's like my mind is trying to land on this point and it just goes and I bring it back and it goes. So it's just all over the place. It's like no matter what, I'm finding myself distracted. And I realize that mentally I'm just restless. I don't want to be quiet. I notice that if I sit in a way that is somewhat uncomfortable, that generally tends to lead to mental restlessness. It doesn't lead so much to physical restlessness. It's like, okay, all right, it's not that painful. I can bear this. You know, the seat's a little too hard. Well, not this one. But, you know, it's like, okay, I can deal with it physically. But my mind doesn't really want to get quiet because, no, I can't really deal with it. So it's just all over the place. Interestingly enough, things I found that are helpful for dealing with restlessness are similar to what's helpful for dealing with sloth and torpor. For sloth and torpor, I find that if I go for a brisk walk, get my energy up, that can be helpful. If I'm really restless, either physically or mentally, if I go for a brisk walk and burn off some of that energy, it can be helpful as well. But yeah, it's sometimes when I'm distracted, there's a theme to it. You know, I just got a great new idea for a computer program I'm going to write, okay? And so that's the wanting. You know, I want to get this program and I'm entertaining myself, okay? But sometimes it's just like no pattern. It's just the mind is all over the place and won't settle down. And I consider that to be mental restlessness.
So when they talk about restless desire, would you say sense desire, when you say sense desire, there's a theme to it. It's like this thing that I want. Whereas if you have just sort of restlessness, you might be going from one thing to another that you might want, or another place you might want to travel to next year, or another book you might want to read. So there's no specific single object of desire.
Right. It's not so much that my mind is desiring, it's that my mind doesn't want to get still. And so since I'm a greed type, I go off into desiring things. But it's also possible to have multiple hindrance attacks, right? And so you're restless, so there's that third hindrance, and there's desire, so it's the first hindrance. So now you've got a multiple hindrance attack going. And because I'm restless because of the aversion to the way I'm sitting, there's a little subtle mental aversion in there, so I actually have the second hindrance going as well. So I got three of them going, right? And then I get all frustrated and go, I can't do this. So now I've got the doubt going. So, and I go, yeah, no, I'm just going to take a nap. Now I got all five of them going. Yeah, when you have a multiple hindrance attack, which one is the most amenable to working with? Okay? So it may be that I have a restless desire thing going on, but I see that none of this stuff is going to be satisfying, and so maybe that's where I put my energy into, like, none of this is going to work. Come on, calm down here. And maybe that, even though I'm working on the desire part, works on the restless. Or I see it's the restless part, and it's like, okay, I just need to go for a brisk walk and just go do that. So it's more like, what do you think will work, and just give it a shot and see. Yeah.
Can you talk a little bit about the difference between working with doubt and sort of healthy skepticism, in particular the issues with sexual abuse in the sauna and without that skepticism?
Right. Yeah. I usually use the word skeptical doubt, and then there can be healthy doubt, right? I mean, we've got these suttas. There's some brilliant stuff there. I doubt that it all came from the Buddha. If I don't doubt that it all came from the Buddha, then I'm going to have to believe that Majjhima Nikaya 123 is literally true, and that when the Buddha was born, he stood up, walked 7 steps to the north, and said in a loud voice, "I'm king of the world, this is my last birth," or something like that. All right? I doubt there were any walking, talking infants there. Right? So my doubt here now comes up, oh, I need to actually look more careful at these suttas. So this is kind of healthy. What suttas were composed for some other reason at a later time? For example, to serve as a buffer against other religions, like Brahmanism, the Jains, the Ajivikas. Right? So this has led me to investigate the suttas in a deeper way. So my doubt about the literal truth, I think, was very healthy. The doubts that get us into trouble are doubt about oneself, in other words, one's ability to follow the path, and that's probably the most pernicious one. And then doubt about, is progress on the spiritual path possible? In other words, it's not that I can't do it, it's that nobody can do it. Or we don't have good enough instructions. Or this whole thing is mythology. So when you find yourself wanting to toss it all out, you've probably gone a bit too far. But taking things provisionally, well, this seems kind of strange, but I'm willing to work with it. Just this week, one of my students from a course I taught in England last fall wrote up her experiences there to publish on a website. And she said she'd heard about these jhanas, but you know, it seemed like some kind of mythical thing. She doubted that it had any validity. But at one point I came and gave a talk in England about them, and she came to the talk and she was like, maybe there is something to it. So the next time I came, she decided to come on the retreat and actually experienced them. So she had doubt, but it wasn't stopping her investigation, right? So it's, you know, go check this stuff out. So if you have doubt, it could be quite healthy. Now, when you start seeing that teachers are breaking the precepts, particularly the sexual misconduct stuff that shows up, then there can be doubt about the skill of the teacher that's doing something like that, and I would say that's quite healthy. Just because someone has a lot of knowledge and can articulate that in a really very approachable manner does not necessarily make them wise. And if they're failing to act on the knowledge that they have such that they act in a wise way, then okay, I'm not sure I want to turn myself over to this person, even though some of the knowledge they have and the way they express it I may find quite beneficial.